Chapter 97. Inviting him to attend the great celebration and carry off first prize. We may believe that Clemens felt little in the spirit of humor, but to such an invitation he must send a cheerful, even if disappointing, answer. To Governor Francis of Missouri. Villa di Quarto, Firenze, May 26, 1904. Dear Governor Francis, it has been a dear wish of mine to exhibit myself at the great fair and get a prize, but circumstances beyond my control have interfered, and I must remain in Florence. Although I have never taken prizes anywhere else, I used to take them at school in Missouri half a century ago, and I ought to be able to repeat now, if I could have a chance. I used to get the medal for good spelling every week, and I could have had the medal for good conduct if there hadn't been so much corruption in Missouri in those days. Still, I got it several times by trading medals and giving boot. I am willing to give boot now, if, however, those days are forever gone by in Missouri, and perhaps it is better so. Nothing ever stops the way it was in this changeable world. Although I cannot be at the fair, I am going to be represented there anyway, by a portrait, by Professor Jelly. You will find it excellent. Good judges here say it is better than the original. They say it has all the merits of the original and keeps still, besides. It sounds like flattery, but it is just true. I suppose you will get a prize, because you have created the most prodigious, and in all ways most wonderful fair the planet has ever seen. Very well, you have indeed earned it. And with it the gratitude of the state and the nation. Sincerely yours, Mark Twain. It was only a few days after the foregoing was written that death entered Villa Quarto unexpectedly at last, for with the first June days Mrs. Clemens had seemed really to improve. It was on Sunday, June 5th, that the end came. Clemens, with his daughter John, had returned from a long drive, during which they had visited a villa with the thought of purchase. On their return they were told that their patient had been better that afternoon than for 3 months. Yet it was only a few hours later that she left them, so suddenly and quietly that even those near her did not at first realize that she was gone. To W.D. Howells, in New York. Villa di Quarto, Florence, June 6, 94. 1904, dear Howells, last night at 9:20 I entered Mrs. Clemens' room to say the usual goodnight, and she was dead, though no one knew it. As he had been cheerfully talking a moment before, she was sitting up in bed as he had not lain down for months, and Katie and the nurse were supporting her. They supposed as he had fainted, and they were holding the oxygen pipe to her mouth, expecting to revive her. I bent over her, and looked in her face, and I think I spoke. I was surprised and troubled that she did not notice me. Then we understood, and our hearts broke. How poor we are today! But how thankful I am that her persecutions are ended. I would not call her back if I could. Today, treasured in her worn Old Testament, I found a dear and gentle letter from you, dated Far Rockaway, September 13, 1896, about our poor Susie's death. I am tired and old. I wish I were with Livy. I send my love and hers to you all. S50. See, in a letter to Twitchell he wrote : how sweet she was in death. How young, how beautiful, how like her dear, girlish self CF 30 years ago. Not a gray hair showing. The family was now without plans for the future until they remembered the summer home of R.W. Gilder at Tyringham, Massachusetts, and the possibility of finding lodgment for themselves in that secluded corner of New England. Clemens wrote without delay, as follows. To R.W. Gilder, in New York. Villa di Quarto, Florence, June 7, 04. Dear Gilder family, I have been worrying and worrying to know what to do. At last I went to the girls with an idea. To ask the Gilders to get us shelter near their summer home. It was the first time they have not shaken their heads. So tomorrow I will cable to you, and shall hope to be in time. An hour ago the best heart that ever beat for me and mine went silent out of this house, and I am as one who wanders and has lost his way. She who is gone was our head, she was our hands. We are now trying to make plans, we who have never made a plan before, nor ever needed to. If she could speak to us, she would make it all simple and easy with a word, and our perplexities would vanish away. If S.E. had known she was near to death, she would have told us where to go, and what to do. But she was not suspecting, neither were we. S.E. had been chatting cheerfully a moment before, and in an instant she was gone from us, and we did not know it. We were not alarmed, we did not know anything had happened. It was a blessed death, she passed away without knowing it. She was all our riches, and she is gone. She was our breath, she was our life, and now we are nothing. We send you our love, and with it the love of you that was in her heart when she died. S. 50. Clemens. Howells wrote his words of sympathy, adding : the character which now remains a memory was one of the most perfect ever formed on the earth. And again, after having received Clemens' letter : I cannot speak of your wife's having kept that letter of mine where she did. You know how it must humiliate a man in his unworthiness, to have anything of his so consecrated. She hallowed what she touched, far beyond priests. To W. D. Howells, in New York. Villa di Quarto, 04. June 12, 6 p.m. Dear Howells, we have to sit and hold our hands and wait in the silence and solitude of this prodigious house. Wait until June 25, then we go to Naples and sail in the Prince Oscar the 26th. There is a ship 12 days earlier, but we came in that one. I see Clara twice a day, morning and evening, greeting, nothing more is allowed. She keeps her bed and says nothing. S.E. has not cried yet. I wish she could cry. It would break Livy's heart to see Clara. We excuse ourselves from all the friends that call, though of course only intimates come. Intimates, but they are not the old friends, the friends of the old times when we laughed. Shall we ever laugh again? If I could only see a dog that I knew in the old times, and could put my arms around his neck, and tell him all, everything, and ease my heart. Think in 3 hours it will be a week, and soon a month, and by a year. How fast our debts fly from us. She loved you so, and was always as pleased as a child with any notice you took of her. Soon your wife will be with you, O fortunate man. And John, whom mine was so fond of. The sight of him was such a delight to her. Lord, the old friends, how dear they are. S. 50. C. Terev. J. R. Twitchell, in Hartford. Villa di Quarto, Florence, June 18, 04. Dear Joe, it is 13 days. I am bewildered, and must remain so for a time longer. It was so sudden, so unexpected. Imagine a man worth $100 million who finds himself suddenly penniless, and $50 million in debt in his old age. I was richer than any other person in the world, and now I am that pauper without peer. Someday I will tell you about it, not now. Mark. A tide of condolence flowed in from all parts of the world. It was impossible to answer all. Only a few who had been their closest friends received a written line, but the little printed acknowledgement which was returned was no mere formality. It was a heartfelt, personal word. They arrived in America in July, and were accompanied by Twitchell to Elmira, and on the 14th Mrs. Clemens was laid to rest by the side of Susie and little Langdon. R. W. Gilder had arranged for them to occupy, for the summer, a cottage on his place at Tyringham, in the Berkshire Hills. By November they were at the Grosvenor, in New York, preparing to establish themselves in a house which they had taken on the corner of 9th Street and 5th Avenue number 21. To F.N. Doubleday, in New York. Dear Doubleday, I did not know you were going to England. I would have freighted you with such messages of homage and affection to Kipling. And I would have pressed his hand, through you, for his sympathy with me in my crushing loss, as expressed by him in his letter to Gilder. You know my feeling for Kipling, and that it antedates that expression. I was glad that the boys came here to invite me to the housewarming, and I think they understood why a man in the shadow of a calamity like mine could not go. It has taken 3 months to repair and renovate our house, corner of 9th and 5th Avenue, but I shall be in it in Iowa 15 days hence. Much of the furniture went into it today from Hartford. We have not seen it for 13 years. Katie Leary, our old housekeeper, who has been in our service more than 24 years, cried when she told me about it today. She said, I'd forgotten it was so beautiful, and it brought Mrs. Clemens right back to me in that old time, when she was so young and lovely. John and my secretary and the servants whom we brought from Italy, because Mrs. Clemens liked them so well, are still keeping house in the Berkshire Hills and waiting. Clara, nervously wrecked by her mother's death, is in the hands of a specialist in 69th St., and I shall not be allowed to have any communication with her, even telephone, for a year. I am in this comfortable little hotel, and still in bed, for I dasn't budge till I'm safe from my pet devil, bronchitis. Isn't it pathetic? 1 hour and 10 minutes before Mrs. Clemens died, I was saying to her, oh day, after 5 months' search, I've found the villa that will content you. Tomorrow you will examine the plans, and give it your consent, and I will buy it. Her eyes danced with pleasure, for she longed for a home of her own. And there, on that morrow, she lay white and cold, and unresponsive to my reverent caresses, a new thing to me, and a new thing to her, that had not happened before in 35 years. I am coming to see you, and Mrs. Doubleday by and by. She loved and honored Mrs. Doubleday and her work. Always yours, Mark. It was a presidential year and the air was thick with politics. Mark Twain was no longer actively interested in the political situation. He was only disheartened by the hollowness and pretense of office-seeking, and the methods of office-seekers in general. Grieved that Twitchell should still pin his faith to any party, when all parties were so obviously venal and time-serving, he wrote an outspoken, and rather somber protest. To Rev. J. H. Twitchell, in Hartford. The Grosvenor, November 4, 04. Oh, dear, get out of that sour party politics, dear Joe. At least with your mouth. We hail only two men who could make speeches for their parties, and preserve their honor and their dignity. One of them is dead. Possibly there were four. I am sorry for John Hay, sorry and ashamed. And yet I know he couldn't help it. He wears the collar, and he had to pay the penalty. Certainly he had no more desire to stand up before a mob of confiding human incapables and debauch them than you had. Certainly he took no more real pleasure in distorting history, concealing facts, propagating immoralities, and appealing to the sordid side of human nature than did you. But he was his party's property, and he had to climb a way down and do it. It is interesting, wonderfully interesting, the miracles which party politics can do with a man's mental and moral makeup. Look at McKinley, Roosevelt, and yourself. In private life, spotless in character, honorable, honest, just, humane, generous, scorning trickeries, treacheries, suppressions of the truth, mistranslations of the meanings of facts, the filching of credit earned by another, the condoning of crime, the glorifying of base acts. In public political life, the reverse of all this. McKinley was a Silverite who concealed it. Roosevelt was a Silverite who concealed it. Parker was a Silverite who published it. Along with a shudder and a warning colon, he was unsafe then. Is he any safer now? Joe, even I could be guilty of such a thing as that if I were in party-politics. I really believe it. Mr. Cleveland gave the country the gold standard. By implication, you credit the matter to the Republican Party. By implication, you prove the whole annual pension scoop, concealing the fact that the bulk of the money goes to people who in no way deserve it. You imply that all the batteners upon this bribery fund are Republicans. An indiscreet confession, since about half of them must have been Democrats before they were bought. You as good as praise Order 78. It is true you do not shout, and you do not linger, you only whisper and skip still. What little you do in the matter is complementary to the crime. It means, if it means anything, that our outlying properties will all be given up by the Democrats, and our flag hauled down. All of them? Not only the properties stolen by Mr. McKinley and Mr. Roosevelt, but the properties honestly acquired? Joe, did you believe that hardy statement when you made it? Yet you made it, and there it stands in permanent print. Now what moral law would suffer if we should give up the stolen ones? But you know our standard bearer. He will maintain all that we have gained by whatever process. Land, I believe you. By George, Joe, you are as handy at the game as if you had been in training for it all your life. Your campaign address is built from the ground up upon the oldest and best models. There isn't a paragraph in it whose facts or morals will wash, not even a sentence, I believe. But you will soon be out of this. You didn't want to do it, that is sufficiently apparent, thanks be. But you couldn't well get out of it. In a few days you will be out of it, and then you can fumigate yourself, and take up your legitimate work again, and resume your clean and wholesome private character once more, and be happy and useful. I know I ought to hand you some guff now, as propitiation and apology for these reproaches, but on the whole I believe I won't. I have inquired, and find that Mitsukurai does not arrive here until 2- Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.